never actually look for them. Clutter is embarrassing. Letting someone help you declutter makes you vulnerable. Every time you take something to the place people say they'd look for it first, you're building trust that you're going to listen to them without criticizing. Asking where they'd look first is giving respect to how they do things in their home, even things that don't make sense to you. A few years ago, before we all had smartphones, we decided to order pizza while at my in-law's house. I asked my mother-in-law where her phone book was. She heavy-sighed and said she had no idea. For years, she kept it in the bottom of her china cabinet, but someone had cleaned out the china cabinet for her and moved the phone book to a much better spot. Better, except she had no idea where it was. The same thing happened to me with plastic Easter eggs. One year, I couldn't find them. They weren't in the cabinet above my washing machine where I had kept them for years. That year, we didn't hunt for eggs because I never did find them and didn't want to buy more. Months and months later, as I was putting blankets up on the top shelf of my linen closet, I saw them. I knew immediately that my mother had moved them there since she's the only person who would have been deep enough in my home to do that. I asked why she put them there, and she said that while she stayed with my kids when my husband and I were out of town, she'd seen them sitting on the floor of the laundry room and decided to find a good place for them. But that wasn't helpful. They became completely useless when I couldn't find them. Ask where the people you're helping would look for something first, put it there, and they'll find things in the first place they look. That will get you invited back for more decluttering. Decluttering question number two. If I needed this item, would it ever occur to me that I already had one? Only ask this question if there's no answer to question number one. If people are adamant they'd know they had it, then ask question number one again. If they don't know where they'd look for it, suggest that the answer to question number two is that they wouldn't look for it and suggest putting it in the donate box. If they can't answer either question and aren't willing to get rid of it, move on. Leave it in this space and hope the next step will help them let it go. Remember, your goals are better and less. So progress is everything. Keep moving forward. Stopping to argue about a deck of cards that's missing the Ace of Spades isn't worth stopping the progress. Step 5. Make it fit. Step 5.1. Consolidate. Put like things together. Fold tablecloths and stack them. Put pillowcases together. You're being the muscle anyway, so do the work that requires no decision-making or emotion. Consolidating opens my own eyes to the realities of my own stuff, and I find it helps the people I'm helping as well. Step 5.2. Purge down to the limits of the container. Again, stick to the facts. If you're sure the tablecloths will be too tall for the shelf when they're all stacked together, ask them to point out their favorite ones to put in first. As the space gets filled, they'll have already identified their favorites and very likely be willing to get rid of the ones that don't fit. If they're not willing, ask what other things, hand towels, washcloths, that they'd like to eliminate so there's room for all of the tablecloths. All decisions are theirs, not yours, and respect their decisions while sticking to the facts about the size of the container. Let the container be the bad guy. If we're talking about messes like magazines and stacks on the floor, offer to fill the nearby magazine holder or shelf. Ask them to point out their favorite magazines first so you can place them on the shelf first. Once the shelf is full, mention that the rest will need to go. I know, they may be horrified, but you honored their choices and you helped. So keep that going, play dumb, and say, "Oh, I'm sorry, well, which do you want to keep?" "Sure, no problem. Which ones on the shelf do you want to get rid of so there's room?" "None?" "Oh, well, where are some empty shelves where I can put the rest?" "I know, it may not work, but the space will be better off than it was because now the favorite magazines are on the shelf, and you'll have introduced the reality of the container concept. Maybe next time they'll accept it." Imperfect decluttering is better than not decluttering. The goal is less. Any decluttering project that ends with less than you had when you started is a success. When time is limited and people are uncooperative, it's hard to leave without feeling as though your effort was wasted. But we're decluttering at the speed of life, remember? And life goes on. The first time you help your relatives declutter is a test, and your goal is to pass that test. Be trustworthy. Be helpful. Don't judge. And if you leave a space that's more functional and nicer than it was before, they get to live with that space after you leave. Living with that decluttered space will make them ready to declutter the next one, and you'll start the next project so much further ahead than you did this one. A few more thoughts. Hoarding. If you're dealing with true hoarding, you will likely need professional help, especially if you are concerned about your relative's health or safety. If they understand there is a problem, want to change, and have asked for help, go through the steps, no matter how severe the mess, and see if they're really ready to let you help. Help with meaning to's. If your relatives are resistant to you helping them declutter, offer to help with things they've been meaning to do. If they have a bag of donations, take it to the local charity for them. If they have a box full of papers to shred, take them to an office store to be shredded. If they don't trust that the people at the office store won't steal their personal information, offer to take them with you to watch the papers get shredded. If they've heard of this thing called Craigslist, where every little item gets top dollar and they won't donate because they believe their stuff is worth money, offer to help them set up listings and arrange the details for them for their safety. If the house is just a complete mess, help them catch up on the basics, do the dishes, help with laundry. If they have way too much stuff to fit in their kitchen, wash everything and help them attempt to put it away so they can see there is too much. Basic housework is difficult to argue against, so focus on that and let it show the need to declutter. Chapter 22, Spouses. This chapter is the last one about helping others declutter. It's also the most difficult and will need the most caveats. Friends could have varying degrees of closeness, history, and trust, but you can follow the steps and advice and make it work. And if it doesn't go well, you can find new friends. Kids could mean boys or girls, nieces or nephews, stepkids or foster children, or a myriad of other unique variations on adult-child relationships. Each of those variations color your interactions. As the adult, you're in a position to direct the decluttering process, ask the questions, and work together. Your relationships with senior citizens may get covered in the friends chapter, or you may be dealing with your own parents or older relatives, which has its own minefield of issues for sure. But still, you're likely going into their homes with the express purpose of helping them declutter. But spouses are their own situation. Going forward, I'll say husbands, because in general, it's wives who talk to me about their frustrations with their husbands and clutter. That's the angle from which I have experience, so that's the angle from which I'll speak. Fact. Your partners. This is very different from your relationship with your children. While it's perfectly acceptable for mom to announce a time to clear out the kids' rooms and ban all fun until it's done, this isn't how a spouse should be treated. I personally don't enjoy being treated like a child, especially when it comes to someone criticizing my clutter issues, and I know this is the generally accepted truth for all adults. So in this chapter, I'm not going to work through the steps to dealing with an overwhelming mess. You know those by now. I'm going to talk about what you can do, because what you can do is all you can do. Go ahead and declutter. Declutter your own stuff. Declutter stuff that's neutral, such as towels or plastic cups. If one of the things I just named is the one thing your spouse refuses to declutter, then choose something else that's neutral. But go ahead, make progress. Purge your own wardrobe and the kids' clothing. Consolidate the kitchen utensils and get rid of the fourth and fifth potato mashers. You cannot control another person. And in a good marriage, you shouldn't want to control the other person. So control what you can control while also respecting that this is your husband's home too. Give him a container. In my 100th podcast episode, I interviewed my husband. One of the questions submitted by listeners for him to answer was, how has Dana helped you declutter? He mentioned that I gave him a special space to keep his 1980s memorabilia, and that made it easy for him to decide what to keep because he filled it first with his favorite things. I said, "Oh, yeah, the container concept." He said, "What?" And I laughed. He had no idea I was implementing limits and practicing my biggest game-changing decluttering concept on him. He just knew I was nice enough and respected his love of his memorabilia enough to give him a place to put it. Do not make decluttering a power struggle. When your spouse doesn't seem to even care what the house looks like, it's difficult. But a power struggle is never healthy in a marriage. Again, do what you can do. Control what you can control without trying to get the upper hand. My mother's best marriage advice was to never say, "I told you so." While everyone likes to be right, no one likes to be wrong. And no one likes the person who reminds them they were wrong. The only reason to ever say, "I told you so," is to point out that you won the power struggle. Just don't. Be happy for the change and don't turn him against you once the change has happened. Trust the power of decluttering momentum. It worked with my husband, and it has worked with many others, as he experienced how much easier it was to live with less stuff after I decluttered my stuff and neutral stuff. His view of stuff changed, and his grip on the things I thought he'd never give up loosened. But this only happened after he watched me be willing to give up things for the sake of an easier-to-manage, more comfortable home. Acknowledge your problems may be deeper than the clutter. If you can't communicate kindly when it comes to clutter, there's most likely a communication problem that's about more than just clutter. Consider counseling, or read a book on communication in marriage, or both. I'm not a marriage counselor. I just declutter. Chapter 23, Accepting Help. Before I finish this section on helping others declutter, I need to address another angle of this issue, accepting help. Some of you are in situations or have health challenges that mean you need help even if you don't want it. Letting someone help is harder than it sounds like it should be. It's even harder when you've been trying to hide your clutter issues from the people in your life. When my boys were toddlers, a friend suggested that because we had kids who were close to the same age and played together well, we should set up cleaning days. She'd come to my house one week and help me clean. The next week, I would go to her house and help her clean. It was a fabulous idea. But I hemmed and hawed and didn't agree. I was too embarrassed. I was so overwhelmed by my messier-than-she-had-any-idea home that I couldn't gather the energy to do the pre-cleaning, decluttering, I'd have to do before I would let her into my home. More than a decade later, I still regret that I didn't jump on this amazing idea. When my second son was born, a close friend who lived in my neighborhood wanted to help me out. She offered to clean my house. Truly, that would have been the most helpful thing, and she identified it and offered it. I said no. I wish I had a time machine to go back and shake some sense into new Mama Dana. I was just too embarrassed. Letting someone pass doors that are usually closed and locked makes you vulnerable. But if you read the previous chapters and thought, "I wish someone would come and help me like this," let me be honest about your role as the helpee. The way in which you accept help and treat your helpers will determine how much progress you make and how willing your helper is to keep helping. You're already doing the most important thing. You're mentally preparing to let things go. You're reading a book about decluttering, trying to be realistic about your own home, and changing your mindset about stuff in general. So step one is to finish this book. Step two is to start throwing away trash as best you can. If you are physically capable, keep throwing away trash until the moment help arrives. Do the easy stuff. Put duhs in donate boxes. You might work for days, or you might only have the stamina to work for 5 minutes at a time. Do what you can, whenever you can, as often as you can. This will do two things. It will help you get past some of the easy stuff, so when your helper arrives, you'll be ready to use his or her muscle and motivation to tackle the not-so-easy stuff. It will also start to change your perspective. I cannot properly explain this phenomenon. Doing the easy stuff changed my thought processes. My attachments changed. My view of stuff changed. My confidence in my ability to survive the loss of my treasure possibilities changed. But that only happened as I got stuff out of my house. Even though you don't believe your love of your stuff could ever change, throw away trash. Maybe you'll be the exception and your attachments will remain strong. But even if they do, you'll have less trash in your home. Paying for help versus asking for favors. If you need help, you have two options. You can pay someone or you can ask someone you know to help you. Paid help. The biggest advantage of paying other people is they are obligated to help you because you're giving them money. There's also some comfort in not having a prior relationship with the person who is coming in to deal with your clutter. Anonymity can be a good thing. You may be motivated to cooperate in a way you might not with family members. Paid helpers will hopefully be objective, not bringing their history with you or their knowledge of your typical excuses into the equation. They don't know the ins and outs of your unique situation, and they will help you see your stuff from the perspective of someone without any personal attachment to it. I have never paid someone, but going from what I've heard from people who have emailed me, I recommend that you hire someone specifically for decluttering rather than organizing. Be honest about your real situation and your real goals. Ask friends for references. Also, check out the websites or social media pages of the people you're considering to get a feel for their personalities and methods to see if they'll fit your needs. Ask them to come by to give you an estimate on how much time they'll need to help you, or set up a single initial session to work on a specific area so you can see if you'll work well together. I've heard stories from people who are forever grateful to the person they hired, and stories from people who burst into tears of frustration the moment the person left. The possible disadvantage of hiring someone is that you're paying good money and don't want to waste it, and this can make the natural frustrations that occur with decluttering even more frustrating. Since all work will be on the clock, you won't have time to go into long explanations of why you want to keep certain things. And depending on the level of clutter, you may find it isn't possible to do as much as you'd like in the amount of time you can afford. If you read the section about helping others and wished for someone who would be the muscle for you so you could direct the process but not have to do the grunt work, consider hiring someone to come in and do the physical labor of decluttering under your direction. Ask friends if they know someone who would like to make some extra money and offer to pay by the hour or by the day. A college student home on break might like the opportunity to earn money this way. Most of all, know that hiring someone to declutter isn't a magic pill. Your mindset will need to change along with your home, and no one can change your mindset but you. Accepting volunteer help. Free help is wonderful, but there are things to consider. Was this your idea or your helper's idea? If you initiate the discussion, you can name the area where you want to start, the most visible area, when you ask for help. This will give direction to the work you do together. If helping you declutter is someone else's idea, accept the help and be thankful for it. Just say you want to work in your living areas, your visible space, first. Honestly, if a family member wants to help you declutter, you're already over the first hurdle, admitting you have clutter. Someone has noticed your clutter and wants to help you. Go ahead and discuss where you'll start so you can be mentally prepared to work on that area when your helper arrives. You are at the mercy of your helper's schedule, so be ready to work when he or she is available to help you. Be ready to accept the help when it's available and be willing to work according to the other person's style of decluttering. Less and better and finishing. If you have someone helping you declutter, you're in a unique situation now that you've read this book. You know specific strategies and the order in which to do them. But there's a decent chance your volunteer helper hasn't read this book and either uses other strategies or doesn't realize there are such things as decluttering strategies. Explain that you've read this book and that the strategies in it make sense to you and you'd love help following them in your home. But if your helper wants to do things his or her way, let it go. Help is help, and maybe the progress you make will make it easier to use these strategies on your own. The main strategy you need to insist on following is decluttering without making a bigger mess. This may mean you spend your time taking things where they go immediately as your helper pulls things out. If you're not physically capable of taking things where they go immediately, and your helper isn't willing to do that, know that your job after he or she leaves will be to eliminate keep piles and keep boxes as quickly as you physically can. Decluttering isn't easy. It's heart-wrenching, takes time, and requires changing the way you've done things in the past and the way you view your stuff. Having someone help you, whether paid or unpaid, can be stressful. Make a conscious choice to view it as a positive thing, as a blessing that will help you move further in your own decluttering efforts more quickly than you could move alone. Part 4, Special Circumstances in Decluttering. Chapter 24, Forced Decluttering, When It All Has to Go. Honestly, the only time I can think of when it all actually has to go is when you're dead. And at that point, I'm assuming you won't care. But there are many times when it might as well all have to go, like moving or cleaning out the home of someone who has died. In the time since I started my deslobification process, I have not moved. I still live in the house where I hit rock bottom. This has given me the advantage of writing from the perspective of the person who is in the hardest decluttering situation of all. Decluttering because it's the right thing to do, not because they're forced to. But as a leading decluttering expert, I've been asked about forced decluttering way too many times to not address the issue in this book. So I'll clarify before I start. This chapter is theory. I'm not a fan of sharing decluttering theories. I've built my strategies according to what works in my own real life. Take this as what it is. A plan I've created based on what I've learned about my unique brain quirks and what does and doesn't work in my relationship with stuff. I'm focusing on what I now understand that I totally didn't understand the last several times I moved. Moving. A new home is a container. When I looked at homes before we bought or rented them, I didn't see them crammed full of stuff, either in reality or in my mind's eye. I was drawn to homes with carefully placed objects and open space. I was always disappointed when they looked nothing like that after we moved in. I didn't understand that the people who lived there when I saw the home were living within the limits of a container. What I did wrong when I moved. I paid no attention to suggestions of how many boxes I'd need. I assumed there was something wrong with the people at the rental truck company when their estimates didn't work in our house. What I think I would do this time. I would use a moving supply calculator to get an idea of how many boxes I should be filling. I searched those words online and quickly found several options. But the questions asked in the calculator I used were geared toward your home. The form asked questions such as this: how many bedrooms do you have? And how many walk-in closets do you have? It also asked if the amount of stuff we had was less, average, or more than most. When I answered those questions, I automatically thought of the house I'm in now with the stuff I have now, but that's the wrong way to answer. For years, I assumed my next house would cure my clutter issues. For years, I was wrong. I took my stuff from one overfilled home to another that was immediately overfilled. I recommend filling out the moving supplies calculator info with the information about the house where you're moving and answer average to the question about how much stuff you have. Buy the number of boxes the calculator recommends. Even if their recommendations are not perfect, my predictions were shockingly far from perfect, and a moving supply company has some experience with moving. They have to know better than I thought I did. Use the recommended number and size of boxes for the space you're moving into as your reality check, your container concept in action. Those boxes are your containers. Just as you'd fill a kitchen shelf with your favorite plates first and then stick the ones that don't fit in the donate box, fill the recommended number of boxes with your favorite must-have items first. Things that don't fit in the container of the moving boxes get donated instead of moved. Do this room by room. I filled out the calculator with no information checked other than kitchen, as if the house only had a kitchen and no other rooms, and it told me the standard boxes recommended for a kitchen. Use this strategy to divide the boxes properly so you don't end up using every single box for a three-bedroom house just on the kitchen. If your goal after reading this book is to live in your container, this is a concrete way to make that happen. You can always buy more boxes later if needed. Follow the steps. If you are overwhelmed with the sheer volume of stuff in your home and the thought of sifting through the mess in search of the best things to put in your boxes makes you want to call your realtor and tell her the deal is off, take a deep breath. Start going through the steps for dealing with an overwhelming mess. Grab a trash bag, go through the living areas first, then the kitchen, and keep going from there. Throw away trash and move the easy stuff to its established homes throughout the house so it will be in the right set of boxes when you unpack. Donate the does. You're lucky because you get a bonus decluttering question. Would I pay to move this? Even if you're not hiring movers, you are paying with your own muscle and your own sweat. You're paying for a bigger truck than you need, and you're paying with extra gas costs and time if you have to make an extra trip for stuff you don't actually want. Would I pay to move this? Is kind of like the head explosion rule. If the question makes you say, get rid of it. Procrastination stops here, ideally. I love deadlines. Love, hate them, at least. My love of deadlines is one of the reasons I struggle with procrastinator. I think to myself, and sometimes say out loud, I'll have to deal with that at some point, so why bother now? But I always, always regret that thought. Your moving day is your deadline. You will declutter more as you unpack in your new home, but don't put off making a decision. Answer the two decluttering questions as you pack. When I taught in Thailand, a parent of one of my students shared her packing comedy nightmare. The company sending them to Bangkok had paid for movers to pack their stuff. They packed everything. Everything. So as she unpacked, she found a black trash bag full of garbage that had traveled overseas. Go ahead and declutter now so you don't end up unpacking trash. Declutter as you unpack. Even if you declutter your entire home and pack up only the things you need, you'll likely have the opportunity to declutter more when you unpack. Since you have to put things away anyway, use the two decluttering questions to decide where you'll put them. If you can't answer the questions, mark one of your bazillion moving boxes as a donate box and get rid of it now. Embrace your new container. As you unpack, you're no longer living in hypothesis land. The moving supplies calculator gave you an estimate, but now you don't need to estimate. You're no longer dreaming of how this new home will solve all your clutter problems. The only thing that will solve clutter problems is living within your new container. As you put away hanging clothes, make them fit. Hang your favorites first and donate the ones that won't fit comfortably on the bar. Put away your favorite coffee cups first and donate the ones that don't fit in that cabinet. Cleaning out a loved one's home. I'm going to talk about the overall process, and I'm going to talk about it as if you are the only one who is going through this process. The one person decluttering the deceased family member's home who has the authority to make decisions about everything in it. Doing this with other family members adds a layer of complexity I'm not qualified to address, neither psychologically nor legally. Maybe you could send them a copy of this book. Or play the audio version aloud as you work together. Sort of kidding. Sort of not. If you have all the time in the world available, I recommend decluttering your own home first. Nothing has changed my view of stuff and given me proper perspective on it more than the act of decluttering. Every time I go through a stack of paper, I start giving the stink eye to any new paper that threatens to enter my home. Every time I purge old towels, I start rolling my eyes at the idea of Grandma's sentimental but not brand new and extra fluffy and oversized towel entering my home. The reason to declutter your own home first is to avoid bringing home more than will fit in your own container, your house. If you don't have time to declutter your own home first, take some pictures of it. Grab your phone and walk around your house, getting photos of entire rooms, closets, and even behind cabinet doors and inside drawers. Do this so when you're tempted to bring something home, you will know for sure whether there is space for it in your home. Once you're inside your loved one's home, work your way through the steps for dealing with an overwhelming mess. Start with a trash bag or a jumbo box of trash bags. Feel free to go through the entire house with this step first. This will give you a realistic understanding of the decluttering you'll be doing over the next days, weeks, months. If this step alone, the trash, is completely overwhelming, look into renting a dumpster. Consider how you'll get rid of the majority of stuff in the home. Will you host an estate sale? Will you donate all of it? If you're planning to hire an estate sale company, ask friends in the area of the home for recommendations now, before you get far into the process. Interview some of the ones recommended and get their perspective on what your role will be in the process. Will they charge you a flat fee and/or a percentage of the proceeds of the sale? How much will they be involved in categorizing and organizing the sale? Who will be responsible for getting rid of the things that don't sell? If you decide to hire someone for this, your job is now to remove the things you do want to keep before they take over. If you will do the majority of the work yourself but plan to sell some pieces to an antique dealer, load up your car with as many of those items as you can on the first day or at most the first week and take them to sell or be appraised. If you are planning to personally list them for sale online, choose 3 items you are certain will bring a lot of money and list them for sale today. This is your reality check. If you sell them, you'll gain the experience of selling and you'll be able to keep on selling things as you continue decluttering this home. If you go to all that trouble and the antique dealer doesn't want anything you brought or the online listing brings no interest at all, your perspective on the other things in the house will change. Do not start making a pile or a room of all the things you'll sell one day when you have the time. I am going to continue with instructions as if you're donating instead of having an estate sale. Either way, start boxing things up. Emotionally, nothing compares to how hard this job is. But physically, it is simpler than moving your own home because the vast majority of stuff in this house will be donated. But please follow this advice. Don't take anything to your house that won't fit in your container. I know, saying that is mean and insensitive, but containers have no emotions. They are impersonal limits. They are cold, hard facts. It's not me. It's the container. If you want to bring something home with you, ask yourself the 2 decluttering questions before you even carry it to your car. If you have an answer to decluttering question number 1, where would you look for it first? Then grab your phone and look at the photos you took of that room before you left your house. Is there a place for it? Are you willing to get rid of something else so it will have space in your container? The size of your house is the size of your house. The size of your kitchen is the size of your kitchen. You can totally bring home your mother's spaghetti pot. You'll just have to get rid of the spaghetti pot you already have to make room for it. The earth felt like it stood still when your mother died. Your life came to a screeching halt. But your kitchen cabinets didn't grow larger. I'm so sorry. If you can't answer decluttering question number 1, move to the 2nd question. Would it occur to you that you already had one? Is it something you'll ever use? If you wouldn't use it, but you love it so, then how will you give it a place in your home so you can treasure it properly? Can you keep one? Is there one platter or one serving spoon that will remind you of your mother's holiday dinners? Will her rolling pin remind you of the biscuits she slathered in butter? Running across one sentimental item brings all the feelings back to me. Tripping over a stack of boxes full of sentimental items brings pain to my toe. Replace, don't add. If you're living in an empty house with no furniture and few dishes, feel free to bring all the stuff from this house you're decluttering home with you. But if you are already living with everything you need or more than you need, that is simply not an option. If you are at the capacity of your container already, replacing is the only option. If something comes into your home, it needs to replace something else. If you aren't willing to let your mother's slow cooker replace your slow cooker, hers needs to be donated. Chapter 25, Decluttering Dreams, Small Ones and big ones. At one point, I decluttered 67 pounds of rusty metal. Getting rid of that metal was getting rid of my dream of being a welder. My father-in-law was a welder. Even though he was retired when my husband and I married, he had a workshop at his house full of welding tools, welding supplies, and the helmet thingies that welders wear. Yes, I totally called it a helmet thingy. Because knowing there are supplies required and some sort of special helmet that keeps you from burning your eyes completely out of your head is as far as I got on my personal welding journey. At some point early in my marriage, the easy access to welding equipment and an expert welding instructor was too much for my idea-loving brain to handle. How in the world could I possibly justify not learning how to weld? So I took the first, totally irrational in retrospect, but totally logical to me at the time, step. I headed to the junkyard. Did you know that if you buy a bunch of scrap metal, you're supposed to have them weigh your vehicle first and then load up the scrap metal and then have them weigh your vehicle again so they can charge you by the difference between the two weights? I didn't, so I did it wrong. And the junkyard guy, after a somewhat dramatic heavy sigh, basically glanced at my pile of scrap metal and told me to give him $3. Heading to the junkyard and collecting rebar, sheet metal, and such was as far as this hobby ever went. But still, I moved that load of random scrap metal 4 hours away when we moved, where it sat in our backyard and rusted. Finally, I threw it away. I didn't even take it to a scrapyard to get my $3 back. I dream of doing cool things, of learning new skills, of being resourceful and crafty and interesting. And when opportunity collides with an idea, I can barely resist. Once upon a time, I didn't even consider resisting. I wanted to bring 67 pounds of metal into my home because I never considered I might not one day be a welder. This chapter is about decluttering dreams, but I'm dividing this subject into two parts. Small dreams and big dreams. Small dreams are things I wanted to do or be, but aren't life-altering if I don't get to do them or be them. Big dreams are life-altering. Small dreams. Craft projects, or welding projects, you never finished are examples of small dreams. Small dreams can be hobbies that sounded great but didn't consume you the way you thought they would. They can be organizing solutions you were sure would work the way they did in the pictures, but totally did not. While the two decluttering questions will take you through everything in your house, decluttering your dreams is nuanced. Is this actually a dream? Or is it a cool thing you thought you might like doing? As a former garage sale addict, aficionado, I was always running across cool stuff. Dreams were often the result of an amazing price and me asking myself, how could I say no? Those weren't dreams. They were opportunities. I once bought 2 shopping bags full of stamps. Rubber stamps, wood stamps, and foam stamps. Someone spent money and time carefully collecting those stamps and then sold the entire collection to me for $1. But I didn't stamp. I occasionally let my kids stamp gift bags for grandparents, but for those 2 or 3 incidents over 2 or 3 years, I stored 60 stamps in my cabinet. When I thought about letting them go, I felt like I was giving up on my dream, even though it was just a cool thing, of being the person who stamps. Did you inherit this dream? Is this your dream or someone else's? Maybe Aunt Glenda was a quilter and you inherited not only her beautiful creations, but her supplies and fabric stash and quilt squares and a full-sized quilt stand. An older neighbor once gave me a large box of glass bottles and etching supplies. She gave them to me because she knew I was creative. I accepted them gladly, but then they sat in my garage for years. I finally had to admit that etching glass is cool, but it isn't my dream. Was collecting the stuff the best part of the dream? I dreamed of being, and assumed I would be, a baker. I watched baking shows and copied baking recipes. I gathered supplies and collected pans, but as real life set in, I realized I wasn't capable of baking regularly. Mostly, I wasn't capable of eating baked goods regularly, and I didn't love baking quite as much as I had assumed I would. But I struggled to declutter because of all the memories I had of collecting that stuff. As always, the container decides. Is this particular dream container worthy? Does this dream-related stuff deserve shelf space more than other reality-related things in your home? When I looked at my stuff that way, I was able to easily part with those bags of stamps. When I finally tackled the clutter in my kitchen, I had to admit I didn't have room for the baking stuff and the kitchen supplies I actually used. Dreams that were only cool ideas were obvious when I understood limits. Not limits to my dreams, but limits to the space available in my home. But remember, start with easy stuff. Don't begin your decluttering journey by tackling dreams. Get rid of easy stuff. Purge things you don't like. Let your perspective change. Learn how to declutter and experience the impact decluttering has on your home so you can apply what you've learned to this difficult stuff. Tips for tackling small dream clutter. Less is a strangely effective decluttering mindset change. Do you need all of the things you've collected for this dream? Or could you survive with less? Having a few stamps was fun, but having two grocery sacks full of stamps was making life more difficult. Even if you're not ready to purge everything related to this dream, look. I have to look. I can't assume I know what is inside of a bag or a cabinet or how I'll feel about individual things in it. I'm always surprised to find things I don't even like or that are obviously trash. And when I get rid of the trash that was mixed in with my dream clutter, I sometimes find there's room in my container to keep it. Do an identity reality check. So many of my small dreams were an identity issue. I had dreamed of being a certain person, and I collected things I thought that person would like to have. I was going to be the mom who threw herself into her family, who made home-cooked meals a reality. I intended to become a community leader who made people feel loved and special by doing things like making homemade cards, homemade stamped cards. My dream clutter represented how I thought my dreams would look once they were reality. I thought I was equipping future me at a bargain price, and I assumed gathering these things was wise. Decluttering the things that represented the person I'd assumed I'd be was heart-aching, because it made me question whether I was living up to the identity I had envisioned. But I did achieve those identities. I cooked for my family. I invested in my community and focused on relationships, and I threw myself wholeheartedly into motherhood. The details of those identities just looked so different from how I'd assumed they'd look. Being the mom who cooked for her family did not mean being the mom who spent hours in the kitchen creating gourmet meals and milling her own flour. It meant shopping sales and pre-cooking meats in bulk so I could get a homemade meal on the table with minimal fuss and limited time. Investing in my community didn't mean fancy dinner parties and homemade hand-stamped greeting cards. It did mean taking an easy-to-freeze meal to a new mama or a friend who was starting chemo. It meant choreographing musicals for 10-year-old kids who needed to know there was more to life than baseball. Throwing myself into my family meant wriggling into my bathing suit every single day of the Texas summer and figuring out how to best use a crock pot instead of a springform pan. I'm all about living with intention, but living out that intention doesn't mean the details look exactly like I thought they might. I didn't have an exact plan, but I collected things as they conveniently crossed my path, assuming future me would know exactly what to do with these things. She was going to have it all together, of course. I'm committed to living for now, for the situation and life stage I am in. Break your paralysis by using your stuff. Stamp something. There's a chance you'll realize stamping is exactly what's been missing in your life for the past who knows how long. But most likely, you'll see you only actually like 3 or 4 of the 50 stamps in your cabinet. You'll realize 6 out of 7 ink pads are completely dry and you don't like this hobby enough to pay full price for more ink. And then decluttering will be easy. Yay for easy. Big dreams. Laughing about welding dreams is one thing. But what about dreams that aren't laughable? What about dreams that cause tears to fall in the midst of random conversations? Dreams of how you thought life would go or who you desperately wanted to be. I got this question from a podcast listener. I've been decluttering like crazy lately and donating a ton of my son's clothes, baby toys, etc., that I've been saving in hopes of having a second child. I'm now 47, my son is 8, and I'm finally accepting the reality that my dream is never going to happen. I'm pushing through with decluttering this stuff and also saving those truly special items, but it's been really emotional for me and I'm grieving. I guess the question is how to get through decluttering when it means you're facing reality and giving up on a dream. It would also be relevant to someone decluttering craft projects, workwear for a career that didn't work out, exercise equipment, items from a failed marriage, whatever. I love that she acknowledges there are similarities between small dreams and the huge life dreams she's letting go. They boil down to this. I thought one day I would blank, but now I've realized I never will. Big dreams and small dreams are completely different, though, in regard to who is in control. I could have welded. I had everything I needed to weld. I just didn't. The pain I feel about giving up on welding is regret. The pain she feels as she realizes she will not have more children is grief. Grief and regret are different things. Big dreams that require decluttering usually also require grief. Require it. Grief is a thing. It happens whether you're planning for it or not. Some people manage to go their entire lives without bringing home a minivan full of things they don't actually need. But no one avoids the pain of life not going exactly as he or she planned. But sometimes you don't realize that what you're going through is grief. When I was a newlywed, a friend shared a great perspective. There's a form of grief that's common in new marriages. As you work to build the so-called perfect relationship, putting time and energy and focus on what it means to do marriage right, you start seeing the flaws in your own childhood and family. While the way your family functioned was normal to you because it was all you knew, working on your own marriage means identifying things you want to do differently. Strangely, there's grief in that. Grief over having grown up in an environment that wasn't as ideal as you'd always assumed it was. Grief over having that veil lifted, over changed memories. This isn't a chapter about marriage, but that conversation opened up a new way of thinking for me. I realized grief is more than intense sadness and can be present at times when you don't even realize you're grieving. Grieving is the process of emotionally navigating a loss. Navigating the loss of a dream is where grief can come as a surprise. It's possible to grieve something you never had. This is what so many people grieving the loss of a loved one are experiencing. The loss of a loved one's presence is devastating, but grief returns in waves as time brings reminders of things that should have happened for that one who is gone. A parent who loses a child also loses the opportunity to visit colleges with that child. A wife who loses her husband, loses the partner who was supposed to be there to help them make daunting decisions. And that's what is important to understand about grief. There are stages, and walking through those stages isn't only important, it's necessary. And unfortunately, unavoidable. Prince Harry of England was interviewed in 2017 on Bryony Gordon's Mad World podcast. He shared that at the age of 28, he finally faced his grief over his mother's death, 16 years after she'd been gone. For years, he thought he could avoid grief, but he couldn't. He had to walk through it. There isn't any way to get around grief. There's only walking through. And even then, it's not about coming out on the other side unscathed. It's about coming out a changed person. The stages of grief are real. Knowing what the phases are doesn't prevent hurt, and getting through them doesn't mean you forget. But understanding that the phases are legitimate and identifying your own stage in the process can help you feel a little less crazy. A lot of my own clutter is directly linked to denial. I have to fight against living in denial. If something is unpleasant or stressful, I'll purposely deny it, ignore it. If I think an email is going to say something I don't want to hear, I put off opening it. But with grief, denial is a phase. It's a legitimate stop on the grief walk trail, and there's no alternate path to walk around it. I have had closets full of denial. Denial that my teaching career was over, that the games and ideas and quizzes I worked so hard to create are truly of no use to me now. I've tripped over boxes full of denial. Denial that I really might never get my master's degree. That my life had really taken a completely different direction. So what's the easiest way to get through denial? Not around, not over, but through? Non-committal decluttering. Touch things. I've said it again and again. Look. Always, always look. Assuming what is in a box or at the back of a shelf does no good whatsoever. But assuming is the hardest thing for me to fight in my war against clutter. I see a mass of stuff and assume it's full of emotions. I assume every last item in the pile, box, or closet will rip my heart right out of my chest. Every single item will represent a part of life I'm not ready to accept as over. If you're fighting denial, give yourself permission to go through your things and not even declutter. Today is the day for letting yourself feel, for touching things, even if not one item goes into the trash bag or the donate box. There's a chance you'll be surprised that the box or cabinet contains things with no emotional value alongside things that are packed with emotions. If you've followed my advice and have already decluttered non-emotional stuff, you will likely be surprised at the effects of the decluttering experience you've gained. But tricking yourself into decluttering is not the point. The point is to just touch the things. Feel the feelings. Remember these things you're keeping out of fear you'll forget. Don't wear mascara. Go for it with zero expectations. And then let yourself live a while. If I make myself look at or read through something I don't want to look at or read through, my brain does strange things after I'm done. When I go back again to that space, whether it's been a year or a month, I generally have a shifted perspective on the stuff that was so difficult last time. I am not a grief counselor, and I don't pretend to understand the intensity of your loss. But if there is a physical representation of that grief, physically holding those items is a way to purposefully walk through the pain. I know from general clutter experience that avoiding doesn't work. There's no perfect way. Do what you want to do. If you feel the need to legally burn boxes without looking inside, go for it. After you check your local burn laws, there's no right way to declutter. Or keep what you are desperate to keep. But acknowledge that the container concept is fact. If you truly can't part with these dreams, what are you willing to part with so you can keep them? Maybe the box full of outgrown Halloween costumes is easy to let go once you realize you need that shelf space for the business suits you can't bear to donate. Maybe maternity clothes can go in the spot where you've kept that box of hand-me-downs you hated so your kid never wore. Or maybe viewing the closet shelf as a container helps you realize you're not willing to let your fear of letting go of tailored jackets keep you from being the mom who can outfit every neighborhood kid as a superhero at the same time. Maybe you're ready to embrace that mom identity and let go of your professional identity. Decluttering is about identifying the stuff you really want to keep in a way that you can handle. Is this stuff making the life you have harder to live? Are you giving priority to things that never happened over the things that are happening now? There's more to your grief than your clutter. Seeing a therapist is what people determined to be emotionally healthy do. Find one in your area or join a grief support group. Tips for tackling big dream clutter. Now that we've spent some time on the touchy-feely side of big, heart-ripping dreams, let's deal with the practical side. I'm going to use the office wardrobe as an example. Please know I am aware your unique dream clutter issue may be completely different and much more significant than an office wardrobe. But if an office wardrobe is your unique issue, also know that I understand how much that wardrobe once represented your identity and how difficult giving up that identity, either voluntarily or by force, can be. Is it truly sentimental or is it a what-if scenario? The money and time spent to collect an expensive office wardrobe can be a legitimate reason to want to hold on to it. But how legitimate is that fear in reality? Are these classic pieces, or are they part of a trend that will be over before you might need them again? Can you reduce, keep one or some? If you've purged easy stuff, like the tops with underarm discoloration from the high-stress meetings you used to have, stains or tears, is it possible to reduce some more? Can you reduce the stock to one or two pairs of black pants instead of the 10 you once justified having? Can you keep the 3 power suits you wore more than anything else? Consolidate. As you've identified dream clutter you truly can't purge, consolidate. Put all of your office wear together instead of letting it mix in with the other clothes in your closet. Physically putting things together is key for my own reality check in my home. I grasp the actual volume of an item I have. So many times, seeing all of it together wakes me up to how much of my home a certain dream is taking up, and that frees me to see it for what it is. Clutter. If office suits were mixed in with yoga pants and college sweatshirts, I would have no idea how much space is being given to office suits. Physically touching things makes me acknowledge them. Do I, no longer a theater teacher, need to keep my costume stash? Maybe not, but I did. When I put the costumes all together, I touched each item before I put it in the container. This helped me get rid of a lot of things I couldn't justify putting in the designated space I had. It also freed other spaces in my home for other things. And if I do need costumes, I can find them more easily. They're together in a spot for costumes. Don't start here. Dreams are difficult to declutter. Don't start with dreams. Get rid of easy stuff first. Decluttering momentum is real, and the worst place to start is with the stuff that makes your heart hurt. Don't start with the stuff that makes you feel like you're donating a piece of your soul. Throw away trash. Get rid of stuff you hate. Clear visible spaces of stuff that has an established, non-emotional place elsewhere in the home. Focus on neutral stuff. One of two things will happen. You'll end up with a space to give these dreams a home and yourself room to live well. Or your perspective will change as you begin valuing space over stuff and living now instead of in the past or the future. And this dream clutter will look very different to you by the time you tackle it. Either way, your house will be better off. The hardest part of giving yourself permission to walk through the stages of grief is knowing that you will come through the stages different than you are now. Change will happen. You will change. And change is scary. But changing doesn't mean forgetting, ignoring, or even giving up. You are ready for change because you're ready for your house to change. That's why you are reading this book. Chapter 26, A Lifestyle of Decluttering. Ultimately, decluttering at the speed of life is a matter of living a lifestyle of decluttering. Acknowledge that decluttering is a constant task and will be a constant task for the rest of your life. Sorry. The good news is that decluttering as a lifestyle won't be overwhelming like it was this first time. The key to preventing the reappearance of overwhelming piles and closets full of stuff is to acknowledge that decluttering needs to be part of your everyday life, and then make it part of your everyday life. Start the big purge today. The only real way to change your view of clutter is to declutter. The only way to break through that paralyzing feeling of being overwhelmed is to declutter. The only way to not be intimidated by the boxes and piles and closets full of stuff is to declutter. And now you know exactly where to start. Grab a trash bag and throw away trash. Decluttering isn't a once-and-for-all task, but it is a task that gets easier every time. And unlike floors that get muddy and dishes that get dirty, once something leaves your home, it's gone. You'll never